Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is November the 27th, 2019. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving Day. A shout out to all the military men and women serving our country and is away from home at this time of the year. We thank you for your services. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, call 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment, hank@pcradioshow.org. What we have on schedule for you this evening? Comcast confirms a December price increase on cable TV and internet customers. U.S. court rules that travelers' cell phones and laptops cannot be searched arbitrarily. The nonprofit Public Interest Registry that maintains .org domain names was sold to a profit-making company. Elon Musk, SpaceX
satellites threaten astronomy itself.
Where are we today with 5G technology? First product look, the browser Brave 1.0. Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro series with a topic of discussion, IT auditors. How to lengthen the battery charge on your smartphone. Only 36% of smartphone users are satisfied with the battery life of their mobile devices. Marty Winston with his All Hands on Tech. Many things for which we should be thankful, but many things for which we may not be quite so thankful. Late breaking news. Comcast confirms a December price increase on cable TV and internet customers. And Comcast has confirmed that the price increase that will go into effect on December the 18th, 2019. Comcast said rising programming costs, most notably for broadcast TV and sports, continue to be the biggest factors driving price increases for all content distributors and their customers. While they'll absorb some of the increased programming costs, they say that they have a significant impact on the cost of their services. Comcast Internet customers will also be seeing a price hike starting on the 18th of December. Internet customers will see the cost of the modem and voice equipment increase. The bad news for cable TV subscribers is that your TV and internet bill is going up by as much as $13.99 a month. This will add up to $167.88 a year in extra costs for your Comcast TV plus internet package. Will this price hike make you cut the cord?
U.S. court rules that travelers' phones and laptops cannot be searched arbitrarily. Any searches conducted at the U.S. border without reasonable suspicion will now be a violation of the Fourth Amendment. A federal court in Boston has ruled that U.S. government agents cannot search phones and laptops of international travelers at airports and other U.S. ports of entry without reasonable suspicion. With the ruling, any warrantless searches will now be deemed as violations of the Fourth Amendment. The American Civil Liberties Union, who raised the action along with Electronic Frontier Foundation, on behalf of 11 travelers who had their laptops and phones searched at the U.S. border, called the ruling a major victory for privacy rights. This ruling significantly advances Fourth Amendment protection to the millions of international travelers who enter the United States every year. By putting an end to the government ability to conduct suspicionless fishing expeditions, the court reaffirms that the border is not a lawless place and that we don't lose our privacy rights when we travel. In her judgment, District Court Judge Denise Casper concluded that searches of the 11 travelers conducted by U.S. Customs and Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which provided access to photographs, contacts, emails, and data that was of a personally and professionally sensitive nature, were breaches of their privacy. Prior to the decision, CBP had long argued that travelers crossing into and out of the U.S. border have no Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. According to the EFF, CBP conducted more than 33,000 searches, almost four times the number from just 3 years prior. The CBP and ICE policies for basic and advanced searches, as presently defined, violate the Fourth Amendment to the extent that the policies do not require reasonable suspicion that the devices contain contraband for both such classes of non-cursory searches and seizure of electronic devices. As a result of the ruling, CBP and ICE will no longer be able to stop travelers arbitrarily. Casper noted in her decision that a person is only reasonably suspicious if government agents can point to specific and articulate facts considered together with the rational inferences that can be drawn from those facts. This is a great day for the travelers who now can cross the international border without fear that the government will, in the absence of any suspicion, ransack the extraordinarily sensitive information we all carry in our electronic devices. The nonprofit Public Interest Registry that maintains .org domain names sold to a profit company. The domain name .org is a generic top-level domain of the domain name system, that's the DNS, used in the internet. The name is truncated from the word organization. It was one of the original domains established in 1985 and has been operated by the Public Interest Registry since 2003. The domain was originally intended for nonprofit entities. The domain is commonly used by schools, open source projects, and communities. The number of registered domains in .org has increased from fewer than 1 million in the 1990s to now tens of millions. The Public Interest Registry that doles out these .org website names just sold itself to a for-profit company. That kind of seems odd for what .org represents. The Public Interest Registry, which is the PIR, which maintains the .org top-level domain, announced that it will be acquired by Ethos Capital, a private equity firm. This move will make PIR, previously a nonprofit domain registry, officially part of a for-profit company, which certainly seems at odds with what .org might represent to some. Originally, .org was an alternative to the .com that was earmarked by commercial entities, which lent itself to nonprofit use. That's not all. On June the 30th this year, ICANN, that's ICANN, the nonprofit that oversees all domain names on the internet, agreed to remove price caps on rates for .org domain names, which was previously pretty cheap. Seems like something a for-profit company might want. Removing price caps wasn't exactly a popular idea when it was first proposed on March the 18th. Only six of the more than 3,000 public comments on the proposal were in favor of the change. In an open letter published May 1st of this year, just days after the comment period had closed, PIR said that it had no specific plans for any price increase for .org, but that was then. And if the rates for .org domains do go up in the future, it could affect nonprofits and institutions that rely on low domain name fees to maintain their websites. .info and .biz, which also used to have price caps, had them removed this year as well.
Elon Musk, SpaceX.
Satellites threaten astronomy itself. If there are lots and lots of bright moving objects in the sky, it tremendously complicates tracking of what's up there. Elon Musk-led space tech company SpaceX wants to bring broadband internet to everybody on the planet by launching tens of thousands of small Starlink satellites to low Earth orbit. The Federal Communications Commission, that's the FCC, already gave SpaceX permission to operate a maximum of 30,000 of them, eight times as many satellites as are currently in orbit, according to the European Space Agency. The company's rapidly rolling the network out yesterday. It launched 60 or more Starlink satellites into orbit, bringing up the total to just 120 so far. 24 deployments are still planned to roll out global internet service by 2021. And that has many astronomers worried. The New York Times reported that not only could the satellite interfere with radio wavelengths of sensitive equipment used by astronomers, but they're already proving to be brighter than expected. Thousands of extremely bright satellites could make it look as if the whole sky is crawling with stars. They could end up interfering with dark sky surveys and large telescopes. If there are lots and lots of bright moving objects in the sky, it tremendously complicates the job and it potentially threatens the science of astronomy itself. It is also argued that photobombing satellites could cause survey telescopes to pick up bright streaks of light. It's really a mess. It's not the first time SpaceX's controversial project has received criticism from scientists. Earlier this year, Scientific American reported that Starlink could end up causing cascades of space junk. In June, the International Astronomical Union, made up of more than 12,000 astronomy professionals, called for the regulation of SpaceX Starlink initiative, arguing that it could interfere with space exploration efforts.
Where are we with 5G today? We hear that we will be a banana republic if we're not competitive in the development and deployment of 5G. We get headline news from the Wall Street Journal that in the race to dominate 5G, China has sprinted ahead. Huawei today is a centerpiece in the escalating trade war between the United States and China. Those concerns are important because of Huawei's reach. Last year, Huawei became the second largest global seller of smartphones, surpassing Apple. Apple's share in the worldwide smartphone market is now 11.8% and 39% in the U.S. market. Huawei Technology is a private company that was founded in 1987 in Shenzhen, located in southern China. The founder and current CEO of Huawei was previously an officer in China's People Liberation Army, the armed forces of the Communist Party of China, and that is the concern because of its tie with the Communist Party of China. The company got its start by manufacturing phone switches and then expanded in the 1990s when it built a series of telecommunications networks both in China and abroad. Since then, the company has mushroomed in size from a regional player into a leading global provider of information and communications technology infrastructure and smart devices. Huawei has become so big that it now sells millions of smartphones annually, prompting several countries to grow concerned that the company may use its technology to spy on customers. Huawei has insisted it has no ties to the Chinese government and that it acts as an independent company. Espionage allegations first surfaced in 2012 when a U.S. congressional panel concluded that both Huawei and ZTE Corporation, a rival Chinese telecom company, could pose a security threat. In early 2018, a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing warned about potential national security threats and discouraged American companies from conducting business with Huawei and ZTE. U.S. intelligence agencies have alleged that Huawei equipment could contain backdoor applications, which would allow the Chinese government to spy on customers internationally. No evidence of these secretive tools have been released publicly, and the company has repeatedly denied these allegations. If there is no evidence of Huawei actively engaging in espionage for the Chinese government, then why the concerns? Progress on the trade war has been going back and forth until the White House figures out how to address China's demand that the United States back off restrictions on tech company Huawei. If Huawei has no linkage with the Chinese government, then why is it a major issue by the Chinese government? And it is of concern. Whatever the U.S. intention behind the trade ban, on May the 15th, Intel and Qualcomm halted shipments of chipsets, and Google stopped Android updates for Huawei smartphones. In less than a month, Huawei expected overseas smartphone shipments fell 40-60% in 2019. The Chinese giant increased its efforts in the domestic markets to offset the fall in overseas shipment. Its smartphone sales in major European markets fell about 2% sequentially in the same period. Huawei has reduced its dependence on U.S. companies for core products. It also cut the production of non-core products that depend on U.S. components. This way, Huawei will continue to do business even if U.S. companies stop shipments again. U.S. companies will lose out on an important customer. In 2018, they earned a combined $11 billion from Huawei. U.S.-based Broadcom reduced its full-year guidance by $2 billion because of Huawei ban. More companies will likely follow Broadcom and cut their guidance. Though Huawei reduced its dependence on U.S. technology, it still depends on Google's Android for its smartphone OS operating system. Huawei said that the company's in-house Harmony OS operating system isn't designed for smartphones. It will start developing a smartphone OS when Android isn't an option. In the meantime, it's developing a backup OS. If Huawei is today dependent on Qualcomm and Google, how is China ahead of the United States in 5G? Well, we are behind in the development and deployment of 5G products and services. China announced at the end of October the commercial rollout of 5G. A key policy priority outlined by the ruling Communist Party. They may have nothing to do with Huawei, but they're sure in the middle of a rollout. According to a Deloitte report out in 2018, China has outspent the United States by approximately $24 billion in wireless communications infrastructure since 2015. 5G is the next generation of mobile internet technology, designed to deliver super-fast data speeds. Its ability to transfer information with minimal delays is seen as making it possible to do things over networks that up to now have been only dreamed about, such as carrying out remote surgery or linking self-driving cars to each other. The basic 5G technology is U.S., but China leads in the development and deployment of 5G products. Huawei has invested more than $4 billion and a decade in the development of the technologies behind its 5G equipment. Any interested party wanting to get into it will need to invest months in diligence and billions in licenses to jump on board. The Huawei platform standards can easily be then the de facto worldwide standards. Huawei has offered the licensing of its entire Huawei 5G platform to any American company that wants to manufacture it and install it and operate it completely independent of Huawei. This offer has been interpreted as a gesture to the United States and an attempt to soften the relentless campaign to frustrate the operations of China's tech giant. It came with a similarly open offer to engage in widespread discussion with the Justice Department, and it was accompanied by Huawei's dropping its lawsuit against the U.S. government. On the surface of it, it was an attempt to build bridges with the administration as the battle continues. But that does not address the politics behind the offer and the complexity in what is being claimed and defended. A buyer would receive perpetual access to Huawei's 5G code and know-how, meaning the company would in effect be sharing 5G technology that is central to Huawei's future revenue growth. The offer was cleverly designed. Source code could be reviewed and modified, little chance of backdoor that way. And with the United States lacking any genuine 5G champion of its own, Huawei would be seen as leveling the playing field. Europe has its champion, Ericsson and Nokia, and China has Huawei, and of course ZTE. This way, there would be a third leg in the stool, right? No, wrong. Life is not that simple and straightforward. And in the battle between Washington and Huawei, set against the backdrop of a U.S. tech cold war with China and the expansive trade talk negotiations, that is especially true. Huawei is bullish about 5G networking equipment, and it maintains its vast R&D investments have enabled it to build a technology lead. That scale provides competitive pricing difficult for others to match. Albeit, detractors claim that this is also down to Chinese state support, that its constant security scrutiny mean it is more and not less safe than others. Telco industry execs will support many of Huawei's claims. Huawei is an innovator. It is noted for networking equipment, just as it is noted for its latest generation of Internet of Things devices, chips, and smartphones. And so the other twist is that the United States is arguably disadvantaged by losing access to this technology, at least in Huawei's view. The major networks do not use this equipment, albeit smaller, more rural networks have done so in the past. Huawei has pointed this as a serious disadvantage for the United States as the country seeks to maintain a lock on elements of global tech. Without the next generation telecom networking champion, how would that work? This then leads to the first key driver for Huawei. They have expanded from building out devices in its own factories to powering devices made by others. And while this is not the first such offer made by the Shenzhen giant, it is the biggest and likely that it will be followed by licensing deals for its Harmony OS operating system, a potential third option to Android and iOS. Huawei has invested more than $4 billion and a decade in the development of the technology behind its 5G equipment, so the one-time payment will not be cheap. An interested party will need to invest months and diligence in billions in licenses. The other key driver is even more critical right now. In offering to open its code to diligence and licensing to the United States, to have competitors scrutinize and evaluate what is behind its products, it becomes almost impossible to claim there are secrets and dangerous backdoors buried inside. And more to the point, how does the United States and not take up the offer to have a look for itself? In practice, the argument will run that the Chinese code is not up to Western standards, that the UK Huawei Cyber Evaluation Unit has called out poor practices and inherent weaknesses, that this issue would be adopted by any licensees. Such weakness could be exploited and enhanced with updates, assuming weakness are not patched and that Huawei updates the code, rather than the providing a one-time load. Once a licensee has built onto the base, such updates might be irrelevant. And this leads to the crux of the problem. This is an attempt to call out a situation it believes is politically motivated and not rooted in facts. If the United States believes what it says, the theory runs, then it would take up the offer, prove its point, and if it doesn't, then the accusations that have been made have nothing to do with security and technology. Earlier in September, Huawei publicly alleged that the United States had threatened, coerced, and enticed existing and former employees to support the legal case against the tech giant. The company also alleged government cyber attack to infiltrate Huawei's internet and intranet information systems. Huawei has invested heavily in R&D for more than 30 years, the company said as it made those allegations. We have 180,000 hardworking employees around the world, and we have won the trust and support of our customers, suppliers, and partners. In the intensifying game of blacklist poker, Huawei just put its cards on the table. Huawei equipment could contain backdoor applications, which would allow the Chinese government to spy on customers internationally. So, Do you trust Huawei not being connected with the Chinese government?
First product look at Brave 1.0. Brave 1.0 is a privacy-first browser released out of beta and has a plan to pay users and publishers for ads. Brave 1.0 is a free open source browser, and the beta version has already drawn 8 million monthly users. But now the full stable release is available for Windows, macOS, Linux, Android, and iOS. I've used it briefly and plan to review it more extensively for usability. Brave promises to prioritize security by blocking third-party ads, trackers, and autoplay videos automatically, so you don't need to go into your settings to ensure greater privacy, though you can adjust those settings if you want to. Several browsers have taken steps to block trackers and ads, but in many cases they're limited or need to be enabled. Firefox started blocking some trackers by default earlier this year. Safari goes a step further by blocking almost all third-party trackers from sites you don't visit frequently, while allowing trackers from sites you check regularly, but limiting their duration to 24 hours. Microsoft Edge is still testing a feature that also only blocks some trackers by default, which should arrive on January the 15th. Google announced in May that it plans to launch some tracker blocking tools, but doesn't plan to block cookies on a large scale and hasn't rolled out those tools quite yet. Instead, the company has said it's expecting to deliver a way to block certain classifications of cookies in Chrome by default in February 2020. Brave Ads sets Brave apart from other browsers. Built-in ad blockers are a little harder to find. Most of the time, you need to download an extension. Chrome automatically blocks ads that fail standards set by Coalition for Better Ads. The mobile versions of Microsoft Edge have a built-in ad blocker, but you need to turn it on. Now, these ad blockers can deal a serious hit to publishers and creators who rely on ad views for revenue. And Google also worried in August that it could lead advertisers to use more nefarious forms of tracking. But what sets Brave apart from other browsers is that it offers a possible solution in Brave Ads, a form of ads that pays you to view them, doesn't access your data, and appears as push notifications rather than web page banners. Brave says that its ads will be targeted to the user, but none of the user's information will leave the browser. You can also adjust the number of ads you've shown each hour. Brave Rewards gives users blockchain tokens when they opt into Brave Ads. If you read an article you really like or want to support your favorite creator, you can give those tokens to sites and creators. Alternatively, you can cash them yourself via Brave's partner Uphold, or eventually exchange these tokens for gift cards and restaurant vouchers. It's an ambitious plan and very, very different on how other browsers operate, but not an entirely unique one. HTC partnered with browser Opera to allow blockchain micropayments to websites on its Exodus phone last year. The question is whether enough consumers and publishers buy into this new system to allow it to work. Micropayments haven't proven viable yet, and similar schemes have had limited traction. Dutch app Blendl lets you purchase individual articles from various news sites for a small fee, but it hasn't had steady success. The Civil Foundation aimed to create ad-free media services built on blockchain, but its token sale failed. Brave's privacy options go beyond blocking ads and trackers. It actually has two private modes, private window and private window with Tor. The first is like any other browser's private or incognito mode. None of your data is saved to your device, but it may still be seen by the websites you visit, your network administrator, or ISP for added security. Brave has a private node that uses Tor, also known as the Onion Router, a browser that hides your information by encrypting it and passing it through three relays, bringing that level of security to your browsing. However, Brave notes you may want to switch to Tor's own browser if security and anonymity are absolutely necessary. Brave's privacy option goes beyond blocking ads. If you're hooked up Chrome, no matter how you slice it, the vast majority of users are, it's easy to move over to Brave. Brave is similar to Chrome, as they're both built off of Chromium. And Brave will even let you use Chrome extensions and themes. The biggest difference is that Brave isn't owned by Google, so using Brave limits the amount of data Google has on you, though other browsers can claim that as well. It'll be interesting to see if Brave's popularity soars now that it's out of beta. It was founded by Brendan Eich, who co-founded Mozilla with its rival Firefox browser. Eich was forced to resign as the CEO of Mozilla in 2014, less than 2 weeks after getting the job, due to a controversial surrounding his $1,000 donation in favor of a ballot proposition to ban same-sex marriage in California some years earlier. Boy, we always get politics involved in technical issues.
Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series with a topic of discussion, IT auditors.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and it's time to get down to business. This is where I give you a little bit of my background and my experience of being an IT professional for decades. Over the years, I have dealt with IT auditors. This is one of the big, huge, major things that actually kind of, some people find it kind of scary. Some people find it really scary. Ooh, I hear about auditors and I think of my last IRS audit. Oh man, I paid a gazillion dollars more than I should have. If only I'd gotten the right tax preparer. You know, and you start thinking about all of these really scary ideas in our minds of what could happen. Now, I've dealt with a lot of IT auditors over the years and in various forms. So initially, years ago, I was just dealing with regular auditors because IT wasn't really audited a whole lot in small companies back in the 90s. It wasn't until later on when, things like Enron happened. You may recall Enron. You may have heard about that. You know, some guys took a few bucks from a few people that they shouldn't have and things like that. So Enron resulted in something called Sarbanes-Oxley, which is referred to as SOX. And under SOX, originally, there was just a matter of a bunch of different things. These are all of the different things you've got to do for financial controls. You have to release this information. You have to control that information and so forth and so on. Along the way, though, they said, okay, we also have to keep track of IT. In their infinite wisdom, Congress set only a few lines in Sarbanes-Oxley saying you have to follow generally accepted controls for IT. The entire section that refers to IT compliance, referred to as SOX 404, was somewhere, from memory, I think it was only about 6, 7, 8 lines long. It was something really short, but it said volumes in what they were talking about because companies like Enron had said, we'll give everybody access. We'll do this. We'll do that. We'll move information around. We don't care about it. We just need to store the information. Well, no, there are certain controls that you need to have in place. You know how you have a password when you log in at the office? Yeah, that's actually something that's considered best practices. You know how you have to request special access to certain areas of the software or certain areas of your network drives and stuff like that? That's part of best practices. Other things that come along with this, doing backups, making sure that your server room is secure, making sure that, X, Y, Z, there's a gazillion different things. So along the way, yes, I've dealt with auditors originally, and it was a lot of, easy bargaining with them. To me, I said, okay, this is the information I've got. What can we utilize with this? How can I get you the information you need? And we worked together. And that was actually really fun for me because I got to solve problems. And that's a lot of what I've done over the years is solve people's technology problems. So we moved forward, and as I started to delve into deeper areas of this, I was involved with various forms of compliance within various IT organizations. IT compliance can be really simple and can be really basic as long as you think about the overall goals that an IT auditor has. They're looking to protect the company. They're looking to protect the interest of the stakeholders, the various shareholders that are in the company. So as long as you think pro-company, you think, in that lines, you can get a lot done. But over those years, I've done a number of different things. One of the areas that was very interesting in regards to audit was a matter of I served as the guy who prepared the company for audit in the IT world. We had actually three of us that were involved with this. And I want to give you kind of an idea of the organization in a nutshell and the three different players in regards to the audit. We had the external auditors. We kind of think of those as the bad guys. They're not really bad guys, but those are the guys that are kind of scary. No, they're really scary because the internal auditors are kind of scary. So you got really scary, kind of scary, and then you had me. I was the guy who came along and said, hey, I know what the auditors are going to look for. And I can sit down with you and we can discuss all of the different issues and we can solve all of the different reporting issues that they're going to find here if we just plan ahead. The last thing you want to deal with is an audit finding. Yeah. So I would sit down. And just as a brief example, dealing with this is a matter of doing all of the right things. So one of the people I sat down with and I spent some time with was the guy who was in charge of all of our backups. And you do backups. Every company should be doing backups. They don't always, and that's another problem altogether. So I said, we need to make sure you're doing backups. How do we prove that you're doing backups? How do we prove that the backups work? So we set together a calendar. This is when you do the backups. Here's the proof that you did the backups. Here's the proof that you chased down any kind of errors from the backups. And oh yeah, here is proof that once every month you went and you tried to restore this file, that database, and that you were successful. You know, if you can prove all of that, if you can sit down and you can document out everything, the auditors come in and they get a smile on their face because they know if you've done everything right, they might find something here or there, but that you've just made their life a lot easier and they don't have to chase down all of the findings that you might have. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Lengthen the battery charge on your smartphone. According to Statista, one of the world's largest statistics portals, only 36% of smartphone users are satisfied with the battery life of mobile devices. Yet a total of 89% of respondents agree that battery life is an important feature on a smartphone. This means that a gaping hole in the market filled with only a handful of devices with removable batteries are available. And unfortunately, there are plenty of manufacturers that do not make removable battery phones anymore. A lot of it has to do with making phones water resistant. Not only that, but removable batteries also often mean you won't be able to get a phone with wireless charging. The sad truth is that manufacturers are not that interested in smartphones with a removable battery. The average customer is more attracted to a very slim form factor and alluring specifications than to what's mostly an optional feature. You may not control smartphone design, but you can control what is draining the battery when it is in use. Apps installed on your smartphone could be the reason why your device doesn't always hold a charge throughout the day. While many of these apps can be helpful, the amount of data tech companies collect on you is downright shocking. These apps could also be the reason why your device doesn't always hold a charge throughout the day, and you might be surprised to find out which popular apps are the most notorious for draining your battery.
Facebook app uses a scary amount of battery life. Unless you change a few settings, it runs constantly in the background and automatically syncs updates and contacts. But don't worry, these issues aren't too hard to fix. Then you have Google Maps, although it's very useful, but it seems the most helpful apps tend to do the most damage to your phone's battery. Google Maps requires an excessive amount of data to run properly and render accurate location details. Thankfully, there are a few things you can do to keep Google Maps from overindulging on your battery life. Stop Maps from updating itself when it's not in use. Turn off GPS mode and adjust the location feature as well, since both require a significant amount of power. If you don't need it and aren't using the app, just switch them off until you need them. And although it's fun, Snapchat is one of those selfish apps that lacks a soft spot for your phone's battery or overall performance. The notification service alone is enough to suck the life from your device. The app also uses a location service to report real-time user location. You should consider switching off the live location feature that feeds your battery. Much like its parent app, Facebook Messenger drains your battery like no other. Once again, it all comes down to what's going on in the background. You aren't stuck with Facebook Messenger if you want to chat with your Facebook friends, though. Facebook realizes what a drain its regular messaging app is, so the social giant created Messenger Lite. Be sure to keep either version of the Facebook Messenger app updated. The latest version will always run the most efficiently and use less of your precious battery life. WhatsApp has the highest active users of any messaging service, and they're beating out Facebook with a reported 1.5 billion users across 180 countries. It might be popular, but it's also a battery drainer, even when you're not using it. That leads us to the first solution. Use it less, and if you're truly concerned about your battery life, find an alternative. If you can't give it up, well, there are a few options. Just like with Facebook, turn off push notifications. You can also stop watching videos through WhatsApp, as those will chip away at your phone's battery even more. When not in use, put your smartphone in airplane mode. Airplane mode, aeroplane mode, flight mode, and offline mode or standalone mode is all really the same thing, is a setting available on smartphones and other portable computers that, when activated, suspends radio frequency signal transmission by the device, thereby disabling Bluetooth, telephony, and Wi-Fi, and GPS may or may not be disabled because it does not involve transmitting radio waves. And finally, give yourself a break. Put your phone down for a few hours and your battery will last longer. Have a conversation in person with someone or go for a walk without your phone. It can be very peaceful.
Marty Winston with his All Hands on Tech. Many things for which we should be thankful, but many things for which we may not be quite so thankful.
Before I get too silly, let me begin by wishing everyone a very happy Thanksgiving. It's one of those times when friends and family discover how very much that there is to share. Not just fabulous feasts, but also fabulous stories of their successes and adventures. It's a wonderful time. Well, modern life and today's technology combine to give us many things for which we should be thankful. And as we're all aware, it also means a good many things for which we may not be quite so thankful. So to keep our appropriate thoughts in balance, I'd like to present my own interpretation of things for which I offer my thanks and things about which I'd rather say no thanks. It's a long list, and you won't have to take notes. So if you're not driving right now, grab your beverage of choice, eggnog or hot buttered rum or whatever it may be. Lean back, put your feet up, and see whether or not you agree. Let's start with the ability to keep in touch with family members just about any time and anywhere. I think we all find that as something that deserves our thanks. But the time vampires of social media, no thanks. Not needing to carry a camera and a calculator, an alarm clock and a pager in addition to a phone. For that, thanks. Spam? No thanks. Voicemail and caller ID so we can always know if somebody who still makes voice calls is trying to get in touch and lets us get back to them. Thank you. Robocalls? No thanks. News, headlines, and updates whenever we want them without waiting for a newspaper to arrive or the TV evening news to air. Thanks. However, fake news or outright lies presented as news under contrived counterfeit credentials that make them masquerade as news, or bogus news engineered by enemy influences to seem like actual news, no thanks. Transportation that gets us where we want to go many times faster and more safely than a century or so ago, thanks. Distracted drivers, careless drivers, scofflaws, compromises in vehicle safety, and laws that let people keep driving when their vision, reaction time, and other factors make that foolish, no thanks. Seeing the Antarctic ozone layer shrink, thanks. Seeing pollution levels rising again, no thanks. Seeing robots taking over dangerous tasks, thanks. Seeing robots taking jobs away from skilled and experienced workers, no thanks. Living in a generation that was able to classroom learn civics and how the government works, thanks. Seeing our younger generations unaware and absent that learning, no thanks. Being able to find entertainment, information, and culture that's constantly electronically accessible over thousands of channels every second of the day, every day, well, thanks. But way too often, finding nothing there that isn't a waste of time, no thanks. Being able to directly collect our incomes, paychecks, Social Security checks, and so on, without having to carry cash and without any danger of having paper checks stolen from mailboxes, thanks. Having almost no way to prevent porch pirates from stealing the packages delivered to our homes, no thanks. Living in an age when Hollywood movies can make our childhood comic book heroes seem real, thanks. Living in an age when Russian meddling can make outrageous lies about our election candidates seem real, no thanks. Breathing more freely with most of the places we go no longer being smoke-filled rooms, thanks. Death and disease to our younger generations through vaping, no thanks. New ways of lighting that provide better light while using less energy, thanks. Jip artists telling lies about the low-cost bulbs on store shelves, no thanks. Cordless power tools that run longer and deliver more power, thanks. Cordless vacuums that are overpowered and can ruin flooring, no thanks. Robot vacuums that can now empty themselves into holding towers, thanks. Robot vacuums that still aren't smart enough to dodge doggy doo-doo, ruining both themselves and the floor when smooshing over it. No thanks. Ooh. Being able to watch vintage TV shows on huge high-def screens. Thanks. Seeing those huge boulders on Roy Rogers and the Lone Ranger were just big painted flat boards? No thanks. Also, no thanks for learning that silver, trigger, and bullet really couldn't respond to conversational instructions. For all the ways we can listen to music now, from tiny things that live in our ears to tabletop pucks that can play and talk and listen, thanks. For making the music sound ugly and for talking and listening while we play it, no thanks. For coming up with browser upgrades with more ways to find what we need faster and using less battery? Thanks. For browsers that don't even need to read over our shoulders to track everything we search and everywhere we go, whew, creepy, no thanks. For unemployment rates dropping again, thanks. But for the gig economy, employers who approach hiring the same way as cheaters having an affair for jobs without benefits, in an economy where people who get benefits aren't required to hold jobs, for vacation time you have to pay for yourself, and health care no one can afford, no thanks. For microwave ovens, smart enough to cook things perfectly without you needing to know where to set the power and cook time, thanks. For that microwave being the only thing in the kitchen most people can operate, meaning never having entrees and side dishes hot at the same time, even when you're only cooking for one, no thanks. For you guys, the people who help pull these shows together and listeners who make the time to listen, thanks. For doing more of these blurbs, no thanks, except to wish you a happy Thanksgiving. Next time, we'll help you look down the road at your improving choices in replacement headlamps for your car. LEDs are part of this, but you may have to indulge in a little extra scrape to keep out of scrapes when using these in the winter. Join me. It will be illuminating.
Thank you, Marty.
Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public.
The Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting on Tuesday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center in Ewing will have a presentation on Windows 10 features that you may not be aware of. Tuesday, December the 3rd, meeting time is 1:30 p.m. in the afternoon, and they're located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on impeachment from a legal point of view. Thursday, December 5th, meeting time, 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams New York Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, December the 6th, and that's their main meeting at 8 p.m. They're located at Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, December the 12th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, and that's located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on transitioning from Windows 7 to Windows 10. I'll be giving the presentation if anyone's interested. Thursday, December the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, and that's in Manhattan, New York. And when you get in there, you need a photo ID and check at the front desk for a room number. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 13th. Yeah, they do have a meeting on Friday the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located on Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium at the Harry J. Shore Hall.
We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and PCRadioShow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.